The Peak Podcast is brought to you by Nutritia and is designed for healthcare professionals only. Danny, a critical care dietitian, is asking the questions in this episode.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this podcast that is focused around nutrition support, both in and following intensive care unit admission during the COVID-19 pandemic. Following on from the two webinars that were hosted by Nutritia on these topics back in April and May, many questions were asked by the audience that ranged from enteral nutrition to monitoring to guidance and to the resources that were available to help during this time. And unfortunately, we didn't have the time to cover all of these questions then because we didn't want to use up everyone's busy evenings. So we are planning on answering some of these questions now. My name is Danny Baer and I'm the Principal Critical Care Dietitian at Guy's and St. Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust in London, and I will be your host for this podcast. And joining me today, remotely of course, I have fellow dietitians Liesl and Judith, both whom were on the previous podcast. Previous webinars, I should say, that you may have heard. So Liesl is the Principal Critical Care Dietitian, also at Guy's and St. Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust, and has been pivotal in leading our critical care department response to the pandemic. So we'll have a wealth of knowledge around the management of patients in the ICU. And Judith is a clinical academic dietitian working and undertaking research in critical care at the Royal Infirmary of Edinburgh, and has recently been appointed as the Critical Care Recovery Service Lead, which quite frankly sounds like an amazing job, and I'm sure we all want it. So Judith will be focusing mainly on the post-ICU patient elements of the questions that we discuss today. So the structure of the podcast will follow the pathway of the patient from ICU to discharge from hospital. And I'll start by asking Liesl questions about nutrition management in ICU, and then we'll hear from Judith. So I'm hoping that we can all get a little bit of additional information from today about some burning questions that you may have wanted to know previously. So I'm going to get started. And as I said, I'm going to start my questions directed to you, Liesl. So welcome this evening. So my first question to you is, how has the provision of nutrition support to patients in the ICU changed during the COVID-19 pandemic, if at all, really? Because maybe it hasn't changed. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts around that question.
Thank you, Danny, and thank you, Nutritia, for the invitation to speak. Yes, so I would say the basics of nutrition support in ICU probably hasn't changed. But what has changed, of course, is the sheer volume of patients that we've been looking after. In our institution alone, we've had over 300 COVID ICU patients. And these were mostly enterally fed patients with only a few requiring parenteral nutrition. So I think we anticipated this large volume, of course, and we tried to simplify how we deliver nutrition support, how we work out requirements or targets. We made cheat sheets for new members of staff and templates that they could use when they were redeployed to help them with their entries. And I think what has changed, of course, is we are very fortunate now to have a wealth of guidance available nationally and probably internationally. From our committee, CCSG, we have the guidance available on feeding in ICU, and it's been recently updated to the post-ICU phase, which Judith can expand on. We have information there on also planning in terms of feeding pumps, what to do in terms of feed planning, training of staff. We also have CCSG guidelines on proning of patients, feeding whilst patients are on NIV, and also guidelines to help for those that had to use bolus feeding. And of course, as I mentioned, several international guidance. So although I think perhaps it's not a different way of doing nutrition support, it's just that the vast majority of patients that we've seen have come through in such a big lot, in big volume.
No, that's really interesting. And from your point of view, you mentioned around bolus feeding there. Did you have to do any bolus feeding in your patients?
So we didn't in our institution, but I know there were institutions that did have to move towards that. So it's good that they did have guidance for that. And with that, of course, we know that we would prioritize the feeding pumps for the patients that are sicker or more unstable. and that they would have to monitor the blood glucose very closely. But in our institution, we did not.
I think that's quite lucky, isn't it? I think the thought of bolus feeding for a lot of us in critical care with these sick patients was quite a nervous thought, I think.
Absolutely.
What about like special supplements or trace elements or vitamins? Did you think about anything different with these patients? Did you give them all a multivitamin, or, you know, did vitamin D come up? And the reason I ask that is, one, because it was a question that was asked from the previous webinars, but there was obviously been a lot of talk around vitamin D in ICU patients in general, but then specific to COVID-19, did you do anything different?
So it's a good question, and we didn't do anything different to our usual practice, actually. And that is simply because there's, well, pre-COVID, there's really not enough information out there yet. But in the COVID population, of course, we just don't know. We don't have enough evidence. So we just, we didn't change practice in terms of provision of micronutrients. So if a patient happened to present that was malnourished, of course, we would consider vitamin and mineral supplementation. Also, if it happened on the rare occasion, I guess, that someone was given a very low volume of enteral feed because patients were on high doses of propofol, if the feed was no longer nutritionally complete, then you could consider giving a micronutrient vitamin supplement. We also know, I know there's a lot of, obviously, vitamin D supplementation is very popular. There are lots of unknowns about it. We know that patients may be deficient, and the levels can fluctuate in ICU patients. And we also know that patients may, low levels of vitamin D may be associated with poorer outcomes. But there's a lot of unknowns in terms of supplementation. And what I think will be very interesting is if we have more data on this, because particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, COVID struck during our winter period, in which we would expect patients to be vitamin D deficient. We didn't do anything differently, but I look forward to seeing some data on this in the future.
No, that's really interesting points. And lastly, I wanted to ask about parenteral versus enteral nutrition in these patients.
Yes.
I know there were lots of discussions around the fact that maybe in Italy or other European countries, a lot of parenteral nutrition was used. Did you find the need to use more PN, or were you mostly focusing on enteral nutrition?
Do you know, I'm trying to remember what we anticipated, probably that we would use more parenteral nutrition, but actually, predominantly, most of our patients were enterally fed. We found that most of our patients were able to manage enteral nutrition, and we were able to manage, you know, GRVs and prokinetics and things around that. Very few of them ended up on parenteral nutrition, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's really interesting. Thank you. So the next question around this is, what kinds of challenges have you faced in ICU with these patients with COVID-19?
So I think initially it was obviously challenging for us all to try and see these patients, and they started coming in sort of thick and fast. And we were then also trying to plan what we were going to do with our staffing and upskilling and training staff. We were also planning on, you know, gaining the additional feeding pumps and making sure we had enough feeding stocks and ancillaries. So this really took a whole big team effort to make this work. But more specifically, I think, related to the patient clinically, the challenges that we originally faced, I think initially we specifically in this institution worked remotely, certainly for the first 2 weeks, and then we went back onto the units. And I think it was very difficult for us to try and do anthropometric assessments, particularly remotely. We obviously had to, you know, phone nursing staff to try and gain an insight into a patient's weight and height, but we weren't able to do physical assessments, and that was difficult. The GI tolerance issue did come up clinically, and this mostly related to the high levels of sedation or paralysis and or proning in patients. But I also feel like this wasn't in every patient. It's sort of they came in batches, and then we had patients with high GRVs. But it seemed to be reasonably short term, and we were able to manage usually with prokinetics and strategies rather than using parenteral nutrition. On top of that, clinically, I think we did have several patients with persistent pyrexia, and so we really had to keep a close eye on the fluid balance, you know, discussing with our teams what the aims were and whether hypernatremia were seen often. So we did actually have to give a lot of extra fluid. and perhaps patients were drier than when we first thought. We did have also a cohort of patients that really struggled with glycemic control, particularly those with existing diabetes. And they required also close monitoring and close liaison with our diabetes teams. We also initially faced a period where removal of the NG tubes were done too early for patients who were stepping down. And I think Judith can speak about that a bit more. But as soon as we told, you know, the team members that actually if someone's just eating a slice of toast, that's not clearly not enough. We need to keep the NG tubes in. And that was done. We had several patients that were also long stay patients, which I guess at the time when we first recorded this webinar or spoke on the webinar in April, we weren't sure whether we would have long stay patients or short stay patients. Well, we've had several long stay patients, and of course that just means we need to monitor very closely and particularly look at these patients in terms of nutrition delivery versus prescription. And then I'd say another sort of clinical challenge, I guess, was just also communicating with the teams. We had to really adapt how we would do this through PPE, which made it a little bit tricky to hear sometimes. There were lots of surge nurses and surge doctors, so you had to really try and identify throughout all the PPE who you were speaking to. But things became a bit slicker after a while once we got all our stickers with job roles on and that sort of thing.
Yeah, gosh, the PPE is so interesting, isn't it? It's the communication. You just don't realize how difficult it is until you're in PPE all day and not able to hear, you know, small things that people are saying that make a really big difference to the patient's management. It's it's pretty crazy.
Absolutely.
And what about any issues with feedstock, or did you find that that was okay? Did you have to make any changes to, feeding protocols because of feed shortages, or did you kind of manage that okay?
We managed it okay because of a team effort, but it did take a lot of planning. And so what we did is we had regular meetings with obviously the companies, and we took probably twice or three times a week, looked at our stock levels of feed and what was being used. And we then set up a system so that we had a second and third line appropriate feed available and ready to use. And if we did run short of a feed, we then obviously communicated this as quickly as possible to the whole of the ICU and put signs up quickly to say, sorry, we are now on a different feed. It's a second line feed. You may or may not be familiar with this, and just give them guidelines on how to do that. And I think that was a really valuable exercise to have all the second and third line feeds, the options available. And, we preempted this by speaking to the teams beforehand and saying, look, we may run short of a few feeds this week or for several weeks. And this is what we're thinking of doing so that they could at least, recognize the new product if that was available.
That communication is really important, isn't it, with the wider team?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, good. Thank you. And my final question for you before I move on to the kind of post ICU section with Judith is, so you mentioned remote working, and I know that this has come up from many other centres that either have been remote working for the whole time during the COVID pandemic, mostly due to the problems with PPE and obviously dietitians being asked not to go onto the unit. But you mentioned that initially at Guy's and St Thomas's that the dietitians did work remotely. I know now everyone's back on the unit. But how did you manage the assessment and monitoring of the patients with remote working? Did you do anything differently, or use any different tools, or did you have any strategies that you used to be able to manage that? Because I think it's quite difficult to do, isn't it, from a dietetic perspective?
Oh, yes. It's really tricky, and it's a good question. And we're only too grateful, actually, that we only had to do the remote working for 2 weeks here at our institution. And we also always had electronic notes, which really helped. I know there are people who had to work remotely and use paper, which is very challenging. For us, in the period where we were working remotely, what we did is we ensured that absolutely every dietitian went to the ICU handover meetings in the morning, so they at least heard enough about the patient. We made sure that they at some point had some face-to-face time with a consultant or nurse in charge to discuss issues. And of course, then they would phone the nurse in charge or the bedside nurse for any questions or updates that they made. And what we did is we also put a buddy system in place. So two dietitians together would work together, and one would go into the unit in PPE and walk around and try and visualize all the patients. And that person would make notes of all the sort of anthropometrics and visualization. And then either take a photo of that, or they would phone down to the buddy in the office to pass that information on. And that's how we did that initially. But I know it's very difficult and very challenging. At our institution, they were also working on a different IT solution that might be an option for some people, where they were using a specific platform with tablets, where nursing staff could then hold up the tablet sort of close to the patient so you could try and do a visual assessment. And of course, if you're working remotely, the monitoring is also really key to try and look at feed delivered versus prescribed, and to try and sort of monitor and prevent harms and risks. I know for people that really struggled and only had paper notes and worked remotely, they found various strategies. So they have used, for example, iPads to take, or they've asked the nurses to take photos of the notes with iPads. And then they created very specific Microsoft Teams accounts for their department. So they were all confidential and secure. And then the pictures on the iPad were then fed back to these accounts. And others used either walkie-talkies or Wi-Fi phones or something similar to that.
That's really interesting. We really had to be quite flexible and innovative with these strategies, didn't we, I think?
Yeah.
Absolutely. From my point of view, the remote working is difficult because as dietitians, you know, a physical assessment is key to us being able to develop a nutrition plan for these patients. And without that, you're kind of running blind. I find that really difficult. And given the number of obese and overweight patients and fluid overload and proning, it's very difficult to estimate the patient's weight anyway. But to then expect the nurse to do that, I think is just makes it even more difficult. So it's nice to be back on the unit, I think.
Absolutely.
No, that's really good. That's great. Thank you so much. That's really interesting. Thanks for sharing your observations, and thank you for all of the work you've done on the guidelines and sharing your experiences with everyone who I am sure will benefit from all of that. So that's wonderful.
Thank you. You're welcome.
I'm going to move on to Judith with the post-ICU stage. Hi, Judith. Welcome. really pleased to have you back again. Judith, as we know, is the post-ICU nutrition guru, so this is wonderful. So my first question to you is that we know as dietitians that post-ICU nutrition plays a huge role in the patient's recovery from ICU. What are some of the main nutritional needs and main challenges that you find these patients face on the wards with regards to nutrition support?
Yeah, thanks, Danny. So if you look firstly at the nutritional needs of post-ICU patients, there's currently no specific evidence to guide nutritional requirements. Paul Wischmeyer is undertaking a longitudinal study of energy expenditure and metabolic effects in patients with COVID-19 from ICU to discharge from hospital. And the study, which is due to be completed in October, will provide data which will guide nutrition in all phases of COVID-19 care. So I think that'll be really useful. From the existing evidence for nutrition in post-ICU patients, the Critical Care Specialist Group of BDA has produced guidance on nutrition recovery and rehab after critical illness. And if you look at the sort of common symptoms that can affect nutritional intake in the COVID-19 population, these are similar to those seen in most sort of long-term ICU patients. So things like weakness, fatigue, breathlessness, and delirium. And patients also experience poor appetite, early satiety, taste changes. And I think the important thing is to explain to the patient that these are common after critical illness and they do resolve over time. And the length of these physiological and psychological changes that take to resolve kind of varies from patient to patient, really. So if you look at appetite, for example, there's been a few studies done in post-ICU patients with varying findings, some suggesting improvements during ward stay, and others found reduced appetite at variable time points of recovery and persisting for 3 months after ICU discharge. So I think it's very difficult to say when these symptoms will resolve for each individual patient. And I think the other issue we're finding which impacts on nutritional intake is a higher incidence of dysphagia. And I think as we learn more about COVID-19, the way patients are managed has continually evolved across the country. So, you know, at the start of the pandemic, we were finding a higher incidence of oral dysphagia associated with tongue weakness in patients who had prolonged intubation, and re-intubation was common. And then sort of as practice changed and more COVID IT, more COVID patients were tracked, we found that the incidence of pharyngeal dysphagia increased.
Mm. Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because actually a lot of the issues that you mention, so those symptoms, are actually not even unique to COVID, are they? They're kind of things that certainly from your research and others we've found are common in the general post-ICU patient also, but maybe seem more in our face at the moment because we've got so many patients coming through, which I guess is a good thing going forward. But I've been finding that really interesting.
Hmm.
What about, like environmental issues on the ward or, hospital issues with the food that might be contributing to, poor appetite and poor oral intake on the ward? Have you noticed any of those aspects that might be causing any issues?
Yeah, I think particularly around mealtimes, they're obviously set in hospital and it's very difficult for these patients if they're managing small amounts that they've only got sort of three mealtimes to negotiate. Again, sort of sleep cycle patterns are often disrupted. So patients sleep during the day and then they're awake at night and there's no sort of food available, which makes it more difficult. And then, patients just have a preference for food, which, again, can't always be provided in hospital and as visitors can't come in, it just makes it more difficult to get the food that they like, which I think we're definitely seeing for people. It's just been really difficult because food's important for people. It's a real social activity, and when you're in often side rooms or it makes it much more difficult for patients to eat and enjoy eating, which is key, I think.
Of course, and particularly when families have not been allowed in and everyone around them is in PPE, and some hospitals move to like paper plates and plastic cutlery, which isn't that enjoyable to eat off unless you're at an amazing picnic. So yeah, I think you're right. All those problems have contributed really. And some of them are fixable, aren't they? And some of them are not so fixable. So
yeah,
just good to know what the issues are so you can kind of stepwise try and do something about it. Thank you for that. So my next question is thinking about we've talked about the ICU and the ward, but how do we make sure that these patients continue to receive the nutrition care that they need in the community if they indeed need it? Is there anything that we can do to ensure that that happens? This is a question actually that came up quite a bit from the post-ICU webinar that you were in, because I think most of us don't really know a lot about what community support is out there from a dietetics perspective.
Yeah, that is a good question. And there has been guidance produced by the critical care specialist group of the BDA again on sort of recovery and rehabilitation for post-ITU patients at home. But I do think there needs to be collaborative working between the acute community dietetic teams. Mm. So agreeing local patient care pathways, referral processes and handover of these patients. And I do think it's important that patients are seen by a dietitian on discharge from hospital, if possible, to look at their ability to afford food, to shop, to cook, and what kind of support are they going to actually have in the community? And then, for the dietitian to consider the type of oral nutritional supplement the patient is discharged with. So, for example, if it's in powder form, does the patient actually have the physical ability to make up a powdered supplement? Do they have a fridge? Can they store the powder supplement? So, and I think for many post-ICU patients, it might not be the most appropriate supplement. And so you might need to liaise with the prescribing support dietitians or the clinical commissioning groups or the health boards to ensure that the sort of local formulary actually lists the products that you're discharging the patient on.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. And to your point around patients being able to afford food and have access to food, I think at the moment that's particularly important, isn't it? Because with all of this, social isolation and shielding and people being furloughed, people may not be able to afford the kinds of foods they used to be able to afford before or have the support to go shopping that they had previously. So making sure, I guess, that we're aware of those circumstances before a patient is discharged home will be, I think, really, really important.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. Do you have any advice for handovers? Do you use like a specific form or anything to hand over your patients to the community?
No, I think we've just kind of adapted over time, and just as we've kind of realised the sort of needs that patients have, it's become, you kind of almost do it without thinking about it. But I think it's to be very clear to sort of describe the patient's journey and the issues that they've had and are likely to have, because a lot of community dietitians don't often see post-ICU patients, so it is very new for them. So I think the provision of information for these dietitians is really key. And I think also, it's important to link in with any existing rehab services that are available. So, you know, there is a need for nutrition for post-hospital discharge, and it's important that, you know, the patients are reviewed and get the right nutrition at the right time. You know, if you think about in the early stages of hospital discharge, the focus might be on giving patients enough nutrition in terms of protein. And then, you know, as patients start to gain weight, you might need to tailor sort of advice that patients get to make sure that they're not gaining too much weight, bearing in mind a lot of these patients may have been overweight or obese to start off with. And that we know from kind of previous data that patients tend to gain fat mass and not lean body mass. So I think advice from dietitians is really key at this point.
Absolutely. Tailoring it to the individual, I think, is really important.
Yeah.
I heard you say the handing over the patient journey there. And to me, that's such an important point because, I mean, with all patients, but particularly with the COVID-19 patients, because we know that probably before they came to the ICU, they were nutritionally compromised. Then they have a really rough journey in ICU where maybe their feeding hasn't been optimal. Then they get to the ward and again, you know, their appetites are poor and they're not eating well. So actually, even if at the point of discharge, you know, the patient's managing more than they were a couple of weeks ago, if you don't know about that journey, it's really difficult to make a proper assessment, I think. So I agree with you, kind of handing over all of those elements is really, really important.
Mm-hmm.
And I will just add there, because I know we often lack kind of patient information sheets, and Louise Albrook is part of the Critical Care Specialist Dietitians Group, has been working really hard over the last year or so to develop lots of patient information sheets that will be hosted on the ICU Steps webinar website, and hopefully will be available soon for people to use, not specific to COVID-19, but for all post-ICU patients. So that'll be really interesting. Thanks, Judith, for sharing all of that information. What a wealth of knowledge you have. So that's really helpful. Thank you. That's pretty much all we've got time for, but I wanted to just end on the question on everyone's lips. This is a question for both you, Liesl and Judith. Are you finding that you have any capacity to collect data, either in ICU or post-ICU, or do you know of anyone who is collecting any data on these patients? And do you think, you know, we might see any information about the kind of specific nutritional requirements in these patients soon? Liesl, I'll get you to answer from your point of view first.
Yes, thanks, Danny. Well, in terms of capacity, I'll say during the surge, we had no time to collect any data. But now we do have a little bit of capacity. And we actually, at our trust at Guy's St Thomas's Hospital, we're just in the process of getting going through governance approval for a service evaluation. So we'll just submit that and start collecting retrospective data, obviously, soon. And then from a national point of view, I'm not aware of nutritional research related to COVID at the moment, but we have asked through our committee, the CCSG VDA committee, we will ask all our members to submit any of their work in terms of their audits or service evaluation collections that they can probably share with us at one of our study days or the BDA research forum later this year.
Fantastic. Judith, what about you? Do you know of anything, or are you managing to find the time to collect any data?
Well, I think like Liesl, during the surge, we didn't have any time, but we are hoping to sort of retrospectively look at some data. And I think nationally, not so much necessarily in terms of research, but just in terms of guidance, I think there is increasing recognition of the role of nutrition in recovery and rehabilitation, which I find very exciting. And, you know, with the recently published guideline from the Faculty of Intensive Care Medicine and work by the Intensive Care Society's National Rehabilitation Forum, both include nutrition and the need for dietetic input throughout the critical care pathway. So I think it is an exciting time for dietitians to get involved in this area.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's, yeah, absolutely key. Thanks so much. Well, hopefully, we do look forward to seeing some of the data soon. And if anyone listening has got anything coming out, we will also look forward to hearing from you. So that's all we have time for tonight. Thanks so much to Judith and Liesl for joining tonight, and also to Nutritia for sponsoring. I think the last few months have been incredibly challenging for all of us, but what I've loved seeing is, first and foremost, how all of the teams from different disciplines have come together and all worked really well together and managed to stay as I think for the most part, pretty positive despite a pretty awful situation. And I'm also really pleased to see that nutrition seems to be much higher on the agenda for both in ICU and post ICU than it ever has been before. So I think watch this space, and I hope that you all continue to take care of yourselves. And I hope that you found this podcast useful. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good day or evening. Bye.
To keep up to date with future episodes of the Beat podcast from Nutritia, make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts on. For more updates on the show, as well as lots of other educational content from Nutritia, sign up to our newsletter at www.nutritia.co.uk. We'll be right back.